Welcome to Business Lives by Vox Markets, the podcast that brings you closer to the people who shape the world of business. We give you an insight into the lives of the individuals who stand out from the crowd. For updates on the latest episodes, please subscribe to our channel.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Justin Urquhart-Stewart, co-founder of Seven Investment Management.
So for my long-term family money, I wanted something which was, you know, fairly dependable, not only to say wildly exciting, but I expect to, when I open up my pension a few years' time, open it up and find the money there and not find Philip Green.
Justin, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Now, if your name doesn't ring a bell with people, I'm sure when they see you, they think, oh, that's the guy, because you are like the guy, the go-to guy. You see almost every day, whenever some of these big institutions or there's something happening in the financial markets, they always come to you looking very smart in your red tie and your red braces, and you seem to have a head full of knowledge. And so you want to dig into how you got to that position, really, Justin, because I know you didn't start out in finance, did you?
No, not at all. No. I actually started off, like a lot of people, you have no idea really what you want to do. Life can be a sort of series of accidents. You'd be lovely to think you had one great master plan of what you were going to do. I originally started off, I actually left school and went off to go and work for a distant cousin down in France on a vineyard. Went off on my motorcycle, and that turned into going several years around France and Italy and Germany on my motorcycle, just literally working on vineyards and actually learning all about it, which I thought was great fun. But on the other hand, not very good for riding motorcycles.
So how do you get from riding around, working in vineyards and your motorbike, how do you get from that to where you are? Because I've read a bit about you, and I'm based in a place called Chandlersfall, which is not far from Southampton. And you ended up studying law, didn't you, in Southampton? Is that right?
I did indeed, yes. So after my stint sort of thinking whether I should go into wine. Actually, it was a couple of friends of mine were at Southampton University, which was a great university for actually European law. And there are very few universities that did that. And they said, come and do that, and maybe you could do wine law. And I thought, marvellous, excellent opportunity. You combine wine and law. What a terrible career could you actually have doing that? But so I went to Southampton, and it was actually a very good degree. I had thoroughly enjoyed my time there. But actually realised quite quickly, law is a fascinating thing to study. But in terms of a career, I don't know, I just didn't find it sort of really going to be that riveting. Why? What was the key thing to it? I suppose the main element to me was you're not creating anything. You're not really actually, creating something new. You almost have to be, particularly as I was trying to be a barrister, you have to have, someone else has to have a bigger problem. And the bigger their problem, the happier you feel. And that's no way to run a career as far as I was concerned.
Yeah. I noticed during your time in university, you had a bit of bad credit. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, I was terrible. If anyone would have said, surely this is the perfect man to be involved in financial services, at that particular moment, I was absolutely useless in terms of actually running credit cards and things like that. And this is a big issue I have now, which is we don't teach people about personal finance. We teach people maths, but why don't we teach people about how to run credit cards, how to actually save up money for a decent retirement? Because the government's not going to be doing it, so you have to learn it. So I found myself actually running out of money. I worked on Southampton Docks for a while, not actually with the name that we obviously share, proud name of Justin, which on the docks probably is not the right name to have, and certainly not a pompous name like Urquhart-Stewart. So my name was John. So John Stewart, and I ended up actually as a shop steward for UCAT, Union of Construction and Allied Technical Trades, on the docks. And I have to say, what a great bunch of people they were. They really were the hard-working individuals who worked really physically very hard indeed, not for a great deal of money. And, it makes you appreciate, actually, therefore, any of the benefits you have in life when you see people who actually having to use their physical labour, their manual labour for their careers. And, those of us who have the benefit of an education to be able to have some choices, then grab it with both hands, because those poor chaps really had a rough time.
Yeah, well, I agree with you on the personal finance, and I think it's so frustrating that I spent, a long time in school studying stuff like Pythagoras' theorem or even long division, and I never ever learned anything about, stocks and shares or mortgages or loans or, you said pensions, anything like this.
Compounding. Yes, simple things like compounding money. I mean, I did a little silly little sort of cartoon video the other week called The Latte Pension, which was basically saying to people, not so much, you know, how much pension do you want, but how much could you live on £20,000? And the answer is, well, not for a great deal, but supposing you could, how much is it going to cost you if you wanted to buy £20,000 worth of income? And the answer is, of course, is £500,000. And you say that to most people and their eyes roll and think, oh, I'm never going to get anywhere near it. Whereas in fact, actually, if you took the cost of, say, two overpriced coffees from one of those trendy coffee shops, had two of those a day, 5 days a week, that's probably £25 a week, £100 a month, £1,200 a year, and you did that for 50 years, and you invested that money at, say, 6.5%, which isn't exactly that bad, actually, that's £500,000 for two cups of coffee. And if someone had explained that to you at an earlier stage in your life, you'd actually have a better idea. And that's one of the things I find, you know, I've always insisted when we set up Seven, we try and go to schools, universities every 6 weeks or so. Doesn't make a huge difference, but it makes some difference to actually say to people, look, it is achievable. This is what you have to do. And this is how you go about it. There's no great science to it. It's actually perfectly logical. But don't leave it too late. And don't leave it to some dodgy salesman who's going to try and flog you a product. Most of this you could easily do for yourselves.
Yeah. Do you know what? I took economics A-level. Most of it I didn't enjoy. But the one thing I always remember I did enjoy was when our economics teacher set us up with a sort of fantasy shares league, you know, and I really loved that, and that's why I got into shares. And I'm also have a background in radio, but I've always loved shares, and I've sort of combined them both to do the podcast about shares, and I love it. And I think, you know, that's the kind of thing I think people should teach. That, I mean, it can be very exciting. Generally, when you've got someone talking about money, it's some guy's drabbling on, and you know, it's not very interesting. And I'm thinking, no, it can be interesting, you know.
Well, you can, because one of the things that I went spent a lot of time doing a few years back was setting up investment clubs. They've gone slightly out of favour now, or out of fashion. But at one stage, there were over sort of about 15,000 clubs in this country. And the whole idea was to teach not just kids, but adults as well. Actually, owning shares, having shares, trading shares can be fun. It doesn't turn you into some terrible capitalist asset stripper. It actually teaches you about how to shares work, how you can buy and sell things, how not to do it as well. But you can do it with a small amount of money because you're all chipping in, say, 30, 40, 50, 60 quid a month. And I still belong to a club of mates of mine who aren't in the city. They're just my old mates. But now it's been going now for about, it must be about 20 years. No, more than that, 30 years. They all have, they're not experts in the city, but they know about stocks and shares. They understand what's going on, which they never would have had otherwise. And some of them are actually now enjoying themselves, actually just having fun doing some trading. It's not punting the house. It's not gambling away. It's actually enjoying the issue of investment. And I always separate out people having a jolly good punt and enjoying that with longer term family investments, where you're not taking that level of risk. You're not there to actually take a big risk. You're there to invest for the longer term so your family's safe and secure across the generations. But then on the side, you can also go and have a punt. And if people call it the financial version of horse racing, why not? Because you can learn about it, and if you make money as well, then so much the better.
Yeah, I mean, I got into stocks and shares, and it's taught me how to, you know, read sort of balance sheets, because I wanted to get better at it. Because when I first started doing it, I seemed to be losing money all the time, so I just want to get better. And I am better at it, because it's like any trade. It takes a long time to learn, and you get better as you go on, and I quite like that. And so how did you first get into financial services then, Justin?
Oh, well, because when I was doing my work as a barrister, and I was actually a useless barrister. It's actually my bar, when you're at the bar, you have someone called a pupil master and your trainer. And he was sort of saying, you realise, of course, Justin, there is more money in crime than defending crime. And so, of course, obviously that immediately leans you towards financial services, where you've got a perfectly good crime, good white collar crime. So actually I went into trade finance in banking. I was working actually in Africa and over in the Far East in Singapore, learning about trade finance, good practical stuff, how you actually get widgets from A to B with trade finance and the foreign exchange and things. But from there, that led me actually in the Far East to actually getting more involved in the investment side. And when we came back to run up just before Big Bang in London in 1986, we had the run up to Big Bang in 84, 85, 86. Where the city of London was opening itself up and trying to make it much more, it's hardly democratic, but actually open more to a broader investment, because it was a bit of a cartel beforehand. And that was fascinating. And you had the privatizations as well, people with a demand and thirst to understand how these things worked. And that enabled me to actually realize, to say, look, not only is there here is a demand people need to know about, but it's something I find absolutely fascinating. And to use a rather corny old line, you can do the right thing. Teach people the responsible way in which they, how they can grow their wealth, their family wealth, and enjoy it at the same time, without necessarily having to put the house on the line, and without turning into some terrible sort of caricature of a silly git in red braces. Well, sorry, that's probably me, actually, but some silly trading person jumping up and down in pyjama suits, you know, buying and selling shares, as you'd see, or options, as you'd often used to see in films like Trading Places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and well, John, I read a bit when you were working with Barclays, you went to Uganda. That was quite an interesting time for you, wasn't it?
It was a slight, I think, interesting time. I had a slight technical hitch there because it was when Amin was leaving, not because I arrived. But we had a few coups there, and unfortunately I got caught up in one of the slight problem there, which put me in hospital for a while. And sadly, a dear friend of mine died shortly because of it as well. But it taught you, I think, a very good lesson that how mortal we all are. But also, I tell you what was fascinating about being in Uganda, particularly after the war they'd had, you know, the poverty and the horror, and also what could you do and what could they do to actually make their economy better. And one of the things that came out of that was actually realizing how the power of using stock markets, investment funds directed into the right areas here for trade and development can improve the value, not just of the countries or the companies, but the people themselves. You go to Uganda now and you'll find it's a country, it's got lots of problems, of course it has, but it's prospering. Those people are now significantly wealthier. And it's not all down to the fact they buy and sell stocks and shares. That's not the case. But actually, the technology and the control of education of finance and how to run businesses is now really very exciting indeed. And you go from there over to the Far East, and we spent a lot of time, got family over in Indonesia. And you can see here, remarkably in the Far East, the rise of the Oriental consumer. And this is very exciting indeed when you see the development of investment markets and people have a greater understanding of what's going on and making the country and the population wealthier. There's still a long way to go, but it's a hell of a difference to what it was just a few years ago.
Because at my daily podcast, I do chat to smaller cap companies, and AIM is a place that, you know, it's feverish. As people follow AIM stocks, you know, it's really exciting. And I know you were involved in establishing AIM back in 1995. So how did that happen? How did that come about, and why?
Well, actually, of course, you have to go back to the history of the stock exchanges, because in 1945 in this country, there were in fact 45 stock exchanges. Okay, most of them were useless, but there were 7 proper stock exchanges. And the primary purpose of a stock exchange is not to buy and sell shares. The primary purpose is to raise capital for business in the most cost-efficient and effective manner. Now, unfortunately, what had happened, the London Stock Exchange had found itself becoming the large international, in fact, the most international market in the world, and turned its back on small businesses. They weren't interested in small companies. Why? Because they don't trade their shares very often. Why? Because they're not always very liquid. So I was actually based in Scotland at the time because we had a big stockbroking operation there. It's where we based, actually, what became Barclays Stockbrokers. So we started a group of us there, actually a small market for smaller local businesses to raise capital. And it wasn't called AIM then, but it started off quite successfully and had about half a dozen companies on it. They didn't trade very often. But actually, the London Stock Exchange, we got extremely annoyed with it because actually it was being quite successful. So eventually they took it over, brought it down to London, called it AIM, the alternative investment market, and unfortunately have now changed it into, I'm afraid, a terrible beast, which is nowhere near the benefit that it used to have of being relatively low cost, low regulation, easy process. And this is one of the things I'm now currently working on again, to actually go back to recreate, not so much regional stock exchanges, but regional investment hubs, so that local people can invest in local businesses and buy those shares. They won't be automatically tradable because they won't be very liquid, but they will be traded in due course, maybe matched orders and things like that. So I expect to see, I would hope to see, and this is really in very early days indeed, a West Country, you know, a Birmingham Investment Exchange, a Northern Powerhouse Stock Exchange, and of course, a Scottish Exchange as well. Not like the old stock exchanges, but very much operating as a sort of junior version of AIM, so that people who know local businesses can actually invest in them. And those local businesses desperately need capital. They're not going to get it from banks because banks provide debt and they're mostly supplying cash flow. They're not always very good at that. But where do they get capital from? Well, private equity and venture capital, that's short term. That's 3 years normally. Equity investing is actually people about buying into growth companies, and that's sometimes 4, 5, 6 years longer term investing, but providing trading opportunities for punters as well. And this, I think, can be very exciting. And it's the technology which is allowing us to do that, to almost reinvigorate and redevelop what AIM should have been. And so watch this space. It's going to take some time, but we're starting on the first stages of it. And I think it could be very exciting.
Do you know what? I love the idea of that, because I can completely understand that people do want to support local. You know, it's not only because they feel like that they should be loyal to local business, but it'll help their own community. And I love that idea. But yeah, excellent.
And companies want to have capital, and so where do they get it from? And a lot of people will know those companies. They know people who are working in those companies. And so, again, as you do and your listeners do, using your technical knowledge, your practical knowledge of companies, reading the balance sheet, but also understanding, because you can see the companies, know the companies, using your knowledge, not inside knowledge, but practical knowledge, to use that as an opportunity to invest in good, growing companies and increase the value. Now, these companies are never going to be very liquid until they get bigger. But that's a state, I'm afraid, of small markets. Anyone who trades in small companies knows full well sometimes there's a price there, buyer no bid. But, I mean, that's one of the problems you have to have. So you might have to have matched orders and things like that. But this is where we need to be able to develop more. And I think that'll be a very exciting opportunity, not just for companies, but also for investors as well.
Yeah. So as far as your personal investment strategy, I mean, do you still invest on a personal level?
Oh, yes, I do. I mean, well, obviously, my business partner and I set up Seven a few years back, and we set that up as actually almost the sort of the antithesis of the trading side, because I looked around the market and I thought, actually, there are not many people I would trust to actually look after my money, not because I regard them as thieves or anything like that, but just I didn't think they were really rather good. So for my long-term family money, I wanted something which was, you know, fairly dependable, not only to say wildly exciting, but I expect to, when I open up my pension a few years' time, open it up and find the money there and not find Philip Green, to be able to actually sit there and the money I expect to be there and giving me the reasonable level of returns. So I wanted something that was really as predictable as possible for long-term money. Get rid of things like commission charges, ISA charges, pension charges, and do it for a family across the generations. You can't make it entertaining, but you make it interesting for people. So do that. And then on the side, then also be able to say, now, let me also have my exciting investing into those smaller companies or the emerging markets, those areas which are interesting, or even into, you know, actually just even the liquid markets at the moment when you're seeing more volatility coming back into markets. When you can sit there and say, that's a very good company, or that's a very good price for that particular option or currency, and I'll be able to buy that on a trading basis and be able to mix the two. So long-term security, and then also short-term excitement.
Excellent. And talking about investments, apart from, say, setting up your company, Seven Investment Management, what has been, say, the single best investment you've made, do you think?
Oh, gosh. Well, as you say, most of it is actually down to actually just, you know, setting up businesses and actually trying to get the benefit from that in the longer term. What has been fun was actually, you know, being able to pick, it's often sometimes quite large companies, but following them in such a way, as Jim Slater used to teach us all to be able to do with the Zulu principle, following good quality businesses, you know their balance sheets, and when you actually see their share price looking completely out of whack, to be able to sit there and say, that's good value, when the rest of the market is all sitting there saying, oh, this is frightening, it's terrible, but you actually know that's a very good, badly priced asset. And be able to go in and do that. And so sometimes it's been the case, sometimes the banks in days gone by. I remember a lovely opportunity a few years back, Standard & Chartered. And all the other banks were being hit by regulatory issues. But Standard & Chartered, it has its problems. But the pricing was completely out.
Yeah, I bought in.
Yeah, and you just buy in, then you sit there and you think, you're not being smug over it. You're actually just using your own knowledge and common sense. When everybody else is actually fretting and watching Bloomberg and actually wondering why they're all following the herd, you don't have to be, you know, a great genius. Most of it is common sense, but backed up with some good research and be able to some good reading, some understanding of what's going on. And you can turn something which sounds like a mystery into something which is actually not only profitable, but heaven forfend, also fun.
Yeah. Now, in 2015, you sold a fund, didn't you, for $100 million. Is that correct?
Well, Seven Investment Management was is the business, and so we the partners in the business, we spread it out as broad as we can, all had investments in it. But you always need to have a somewhere along the line an institution. But I wanted to have an institution who was a long-term institution, and in fact, it's a firm. It's actually an investment trust called Caledonia, which is actually the investment trust of the Kayser family, the old shipping company called Kayser. And they are that average investment period for businesses is over a decade. So good long-term investors, which I wanted to be able to have. So they bought into that. And so it meant that a lot of the staff and management could benefit from it. We've all got still investments and shares in it, and that's going to continue to grow now. And so we're working on the next stages of that to make sure we can actually get it into the next area of development, which is going to create more automation, creating more games, a terrible word, gamification, but getting game software into investment management so people who aren't in the industry can have a better understanding of how things are actually operating using software games technology.
Excellent stuff. So let's summarize, Justin, if you could. What would you say so far been, if you can pinpoint it, a career highlight and maybe a low point as well?
I think my low point has to have been when sitting in a really nasty place in Uganda, having had that dreadful accident at a roadblock. That was a low point because it took a long time to sort that out and get repaired again. And I owe a great debt to the nurses in Uganda and people who put me back together over quite a significant period of time. And that was a low point. And then also the times when you're setting up businesses and you realize, of course, everything's on the table. I had to resign from Barclays in 2000 because I really disagreed with the way they were running this business. They were running it for the benefit of themselves. They even managed to introduce an inactivity fee. So you get charged for doing something and you get charged for doing nothing. And you thought, this is outrageous. So that's where Tom and I then set off to go and set up Seven. So you turn around to your wife and family and say, look, darling, do you mind? Actually, we're going to have to put the house up on hock again, and we're going to have to start all over again. Remember all those lovely share option schemes that we had and things like that? Well, actually, we've just burnt them. So you go back to basics. And actually, it's quite a frightening moment sometimes when you've got rid of all those assets that you thought you had, albeit paper ones given to you by these lovely great banks. And you have to sit there with your cash machine and look at the cash card and say, I hope there's something in there. And you have to start all over again, and you build it up, and you really appreciate it then, because it's the work and effort that you and your team have done, not only to actually create a valuable business, but the benefit you've provided to clients on the basis that you've made them wealthier. And this should be the whole drive of our industry, not to extract money from clients, but to be totally linked to the success of the clients. If they do well, we can do well. If we're doing badly for them, we should do badly. And not to actually reverse that, which I find often is the case in our industry.
Yeah. So was there a point where you actually started there where it was very touch and go, and you said you were scared, and how did you start? How did you go from, apart from having contacts and knowing a lot of people, how did you get it going?
Well, it's quite funny because you actually go around various people. In fact, I went to the firm who eventually invested in us later on when we were very successful, Caledonia, who said, we love the idea of what you want to do, but we don't do startups. And you went along to a lot of the sort of people who would be the venture capitalists and things. And they would look at it and say, well, show me actually you've got a business first. But hang on, I've got to start the business. How can you actually get the capital to start? And the answer is you have to actually cobble together, borrow, get friends together, and you have to take the risk to be able to get that going. And it is a risk, and it can be very rather frightening. What I'm encouraged by now, and something I try and to support much more, is far greater access to capital for startups. Because the great thing has happened in Britain over the past 40 years. Over 40 years ago, we set up between 150 and 180,000 businesses a year, something like that. Unfortunately, the death rate is about a third to a half over 5 years. Then that number about 15 years ago went over 500,000. And then about 6-7 years ago went over 600,000 a year. We have become one of the most entrepreneurial countries in the world, you know, per head. More than France, more than Germany, and more than most states in America. And yet you think we didn't have a history of this. That's really changed. Now, what, with that, we've been able to try and also develop more access to things like angels funds, more startup funds and things like that, so that people can, it's still risky setting up businesses, but at least they can have access to the starter pack to actually get them going. And that, I think, is what Britain now makes it one of the most exciting areas. So whatever your views are of the politicians, if your views are on Brexit and things like that, actually, we can still make sure we're an incredibly vibrant economy, and it's down to the individuals themselves. It's not down to the politicians. It's not going to be down to all the regulators and things like that. They're always going to be there, but it's down to us and having the courage and confidence to be able to surround yourself with, you know, people who are, have the expertise, because we, none of us can do it on our own. You have to do it with others, and to be able to have the courage to have a go. And if you have a go, and you may go wrong a couple of times, but eventually you will get it right.
Yeah, and so you're sitting here, Seven Investment Manager is a successful business. How much do you have under management at the moment?
It's now just over, I think it's now 13 billion of assets, which is a huge amount of money, but it's a huge privilege to be able to say to people, thank you for giving us your hard-earned money. For us to then be able to look after and actually grow for you. And this is always something I always ram home to people the entire time. It's not our money, it's their money. They worked really hard for it. We've got to treasure it for them. So having that sum from naught over a period from 2001 to where we are now has been great. It's been a steady flow. And there's a lot more new businesses coming up with a lot of people with new ideas. And that's great, because more competition there, more ideas. It keeps everyone fresh and dynamic and gives people more choice, and that's got to be good.
Yeah. Okay, last question, Justin. It's a bit of advice. Let's say you're going to give advice to your 25-year-old self and you have £1,000 in your pocket as a 25-year-old. What would you do with it?
Number one, and this is something I always look for anybody I see who's coming in for a job, don't lose your enthusiasm. Your enthusiasm that actually it's going to be all right. It doesn't have to be, you know, stupid enthusiasm, but positive. An outlook to actually say, I can get up in the morning and I'm going to have a go. The number of times I come across people coming for job interviews, and I wonder how on earth they do get up in the morning. So it's that sort of element to be able to do so. Secondly, if I got my £1,000, what am I going to be able to do to try and make sure I can actually try and grow that into something? And the answer is try and then actually surround yourself by a group of people, who all of whom have got different areas of expertise. That will be finance, that will be marketing, that will be technology. And to be able to sit down with them and be able to actually come up with the ideas. That £1,000 could just be spent, frankly, on tea and donuts, to be able to actually just come up with those ideas and then say, right, let's try some of them out. No one individual can do it on their own. Branson didn't do it on his own. He just got lots of other bright people around him, and he's the brand name in front of it. And that's the same what all the rest of us can do. So £1,000, not just to go and put into the market, but actually to put into actually getting other people's ideas and thoughts to come up with something which is original and different. And from that, there's your future.
Excellent. Justin, good to chat to you. And hopefully we'll chat again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
I look forward to it. Thank you very much. It's been a great privilege. Thank you.
For updates on the latest episodes, please subscribe to our channel.